Thank you. played with Albert Island for 14 shows and 15 nights or whatever it was, yeah. 12 shows and 15 nights. I'm assuming virtually, that I guess from the three concerts that I've heard of it, or four concerts, it's roughly the same repertoire every night. Mm-hmm. The band had worked up a routine and they played through it consistently, something like what they had played in New York at that time. Was there a way that you could assess and say, well, this was a good night, or we really burned this night, or it was really strong, or we got to work on this, or you know, it didn't quite fall together? Was there such a thing as a good night and a bad night for that band?
I don't think so. I think in reaction was probably, you know, audience reaction was what we, you know, well, that's what I would judge it as, whether they, you know, whether we got over or didn't, or
right,
you know, we were working. We were working musicians, and we were just putting out our stuff, trying to do the best. And you know, I was a big time thing in concerts and people and. People yelling, "Who's that swing?" You know, that's when we got to France, and you know, it was people excited about it. You know, I mean, it's like the road show coming to town. You know, I mean, the Bingo Long or whatever.
Yeah. Well, so, did you when we hear Albert Eiler now, and I'm speaking as a person who never knew him, but know his music from records and the little snippets of, you know, his personality you can gather from interviews or from talking with the Bill Falwells of the world or whatever.
Oh, my God, how many are there?
79.
Okay.
We try to build a picture of who this person is, and his musical persona seems so extreme or seems so forthright that we're trying to still come up with how it is that he behaved as a person. Did you remember having a sense that Albert could walk on stage just coming off the street and sound the way he sounded, or did he have any need to psych himself into it, or to focus, to concentrate, to meditate, to you know, prepare himself for a performance?
That's a good question, because he just... You know, under those circumstances, he just came out and played, is what he did, and well, that's what we all did. But he definitely, that's what he did, and we meditate. I'm sure he did. You know, how can you, when somebody's meditating? Are you meditating? Yeah. What do you do? I mean, he was going out, and he was trying to make it.
Yeah.
He was doing his stuff. He had his package, and he was trying to get us more work, et cetera, et cetera. And by the time we finally got to England, everything kind of went nuts.
That was the add-on to the trip at the end.
Oh, it was an add-on?
I'm asking you. It wasn't at the... That was the last stop? Before.
That was the last stop. We got to England, and I went through customs without a problem, and then I'm sitting out in the bus, and like an hour and a half later, they finally came out, the rest of the band, and they were just mad as hell. And what happened? Oh, they searched us. They, you know, took us strip searches coming into England, and you know, and they, so nobody, they didn't stop us or anything, but they were accosted, not right. accosted, but they were searched.
Right.
And we got to the hotel, and they were mad. Albert and Fever and Donald were just mad, and they didn't like the hotel where we were staying. It was cold, and so they went off into England, I mean into London.
Right.
And disappeared, and we had a rehearsal for the TV show that was the last show. It was just a TV taping. Right. In front of an audience. And so, you know how the TV people are. They want to have their stuff there. You want to, you know, put that chalk on the floor, stand there. We want to know how close we're going to have to get to you, what's going to happen, la, la, la. And there wasn't any Albert or any Donald or any Beaver there to do the rehearsal.
Right.
And nobody knew where they were. So.
So what do you do?
We just, you know, drop back and punt. We just... You know, well, they'll be here, no problem. You know, there's people trying to convince everything.
This is a rehearsal on the day of the taping?
Day of the taping.
And you and Michelle were the only ones who you got... Let me back up for just a minute. You think you got through customs free because you were
free, white, and Christian, probably.
Exactly. And they got a hard time because they had dark skin.
Yeah. That's what, I mean, that's what, if that wasn't the truth, that's what they felt, and sure. So there you are. And it doesn't matter.
So did the rehearsal ever happen, or was
it? Yeah, we were there rehearsing, but we never had rehearsed with Albert or anything. And I, now we must have only been there one night, you know, near as I can tell.
Right.
I think they changed the hotels for us, trying to keep us happy. And they got Albert, and then we went and played the concert, and they hated the concert.
You mean, by the concert, you mean the recording?
The recording, tape.
But there wasn't a live audience there?
I think so.
This is
it was at the School of Mathematics.
School of Economics.
Economics, right. Yeah. And they had an audience, and I guess they burned the tape immediately. I don't know. They were so mad. They was not too happy. And I had, traveling on the bus, coming from Denmark or whatever to France, Sonny Rollins was in front of me, and I was carrying my bass off, and I missed the bottom step and fell out of the bus on top of my bass, and my arm was hurting, and I got on the plane, got to France, and they said, well, you better go see a doctor. So I just kind of split from them in France and went to the hospital, and they shot me, put some, you know, oh, we better put a shot in there, you can take care of that. And my arms, you know, just, so I was not a happy camper at that point. I had my own little problem because I was in pain and et cetera, et cetera.
Did you miss a show in France because of that?
No. No, we just went on and played anyway. It was just difficult to move around.
Right.
Did anyway. So, hey, I was a professional musician. Professional. And then at the same time, something happened in France. Albert said, oh, you know, I got robbed. You know, they had paid. We never had seen any money, and I guess whoever had paid. We're running on tape. Look at that. Had given Albert the money,
right?
And then he said he got held up in France and lost all the money. So here we're coming back to New York without any money. You know, for the trip, you know, that what was I doing there if I wasn't going to get paid? So, yeah, it was.
You're saying that Albert suspected funny business with him not getting paid, or that literally there was a thief that took his money?
Albert said he'd gotten paid, but the money was stolen from him.
I see.
You know, who knows?
Yeah.
He had some nice suits when he came home, so I. Anyway, that's another story.
Right.
But when we got back, then what's his name?
Ween?
Yeah.
George
Ween straightened us. You know, he paid everybody. Right. You know, we went in the office. He said, what are we on? And he paid us all. So we were happy again. And then that was my first and trip with Albert, and that was my experience.
Right. Let me jump back to London for just a minute. That recording is sort of legendary, and I think that event is legendary for exactly the reason that you mentioned, either because the British weren't ready for it or they just judged that it was not compatible with the television series that they were running. That tape never aired as part of the series and may not even exist as audio or as video anymore. Would you say that the music you played in London was any different?
No.
It was exactly the same.
Exactly the same as all the stuff we played. You know, I mean, we had our little tunes, and we played them pretty much in the same order.
With the same energy, same?
Yep, same energy, same.
Huh.
May have been a little angrier than London. I don't know. You know, but how you know, I mean, it's hard to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's remarkable.
Well, it was definitely a high point in my life, though.
A big step for the musical career of Bill Falwell and the way that some of the world, at least, would first recognize your name on some of the, I guess, all the records from that tour are posthumous, that, you know, had to be, you know, overseas looking at it to know that you were there. But now we know about it. And did you stay in touch with Albert once you came back?
I lost touch with him.
Well, wait, let me ask, actually, there is one thing, maybe you can tell me if I'm wrong, that you played a gig in the Village, at the Village Vanguard, I believe,
with the same band,
right.
Except there was another bass player as well.
You mentioned before that Albert liked the idea that you were bowing so much, or liked that you mm-hmm. bowed in his music. Do you think the addition of another bass player was so that there could be additional bowing strength, or maybe so there could be somebody bowing and somebody plucking?
Maybe because Henry, it wasn't it Henry Grimes that played, and he just was there when at the gig.
Right.
And I can't remember, I don't remember the time from when that gig was, it's probably documented as, and when we came back from Europe, how
very close, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, somewhere in there.
So, hey, we're going to do a gig at the Village Vanguard. Same, you know, we're just going to go down there and do that.
Right.
And they recorded that.
Yep. Thankfully.
Thankfully.
Well, and then there's another one. Let me follow the same string thread for a minute. The next time that Albert played in public that we know about is the Village Theater concert on 2nd Avenue, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And this time there's more strings. It's Michelle playing violin, you playing bass, Joel Friedman playing cello,
right.
And I think Alan Silva is playing bass,
right.
too. And at least, and you know, that whole entourage is strong on the bow rather than on plucking. And you know, some people have actually held that up, not totally without mirth, and said, here it is, Albert Eiler with strings. Did you have any insight about how he came up to that concept, that he wanted to add on string players?
Maybe he just liked foundation,
yeah,
to play on. I mean when you got a lot of strings doing a lot of different stuff on, I mean it's really something to lay on as far as building something where he was. And I can't really put myself into his mind, but
there have been any special rehearsals for something like that, or just
I don't recall. You know, at that point it was just kind of show up, and because I knew what, you know, was expected.
Yeah.
We did rehearse, we did play at the Newport Festival, where was that in that continuum?
That's about 6 months later.
6 months later.
Middle of 67. Yeah.
And we did rehearse for that. I remember at that time I had kind of jumped ship and was playing with the rock and roll band. And the Ars Nova was rehearsing with them, and had gotten one of those Ampeg basses, those solid plastic basses that
right.
Upright,
right, meant fretless. To be plugged in.
And I got him a rehearsal with some of dancer friends of mine down in the East. I can't remember. But they had a loft down there, rehearsed down there, and I brought that with the amp and bowed with that. And
you're saying you got a rehearsal for Ars Nova or for Albert?
For Albert.
With some dancers?
Not Dan. We just used their space.
Oh, you used their space, right.
Used their loft and had them down there. And
that was part of the preparations for the
Newport
show.
And I said, what do you think of that? You know, because he'd play louder and I could turn up, you know.
Right.
It was almost too much for me. That was a little too much, because you know, I could just turn up much further.
Right.
But anyway, it was humorous. But he said, "No, I don't think so. I'll just bring your regular bass for that."
And that's what you took to Newport.
Yeah.
Was the hall, the
yeah the regular wooden bass.
Right. Falwell, and resuming, I guess, at a point of several transitions in your career, the beginning of some associations, and coming down off the high of making your first world tour with Name Band, and maybe realizing some ambitions there that you had had since you were a teenager back in
before
the top
that,
of the 50s.
I was just a little,
just a wee tyke.
Wee tyke. That's it.
So here's Bill Falwell, the bass player, branching out as, I guess, popular music had finally taken the cue from several international successes, who shall remain nameless, in the mid-60s, and branched out to say, well, this is where the music's going. It's going to be rock and roll, and we're going to have, well, among other things, we're going to have an electric bass. And first you had an electric upright, and then you switched to the Fender for a moment, or took up the Fender.
That was that's a whole other story, and I don't even know if I want to go into it. It's so painful. The rock and roll experience. I mean, rehearsing in a loft and getting something together and then getting a manager that believes in you, that's one thing, and then a manager that's hawking you to somebody. And the only, we're not playing gigs, we're just still rehearsing in a loft, and we had a little half-hour show that was just nonstop wonderful, and he'd right. bring different people by, and he finally brought by Elektra Records, Paul Rothschild, and they say, oh yeah, we'll sign you. Ars Nova is born, and it had, you know, five separate personalities, and well, they trooped us off to record in Hollywood with Paul Rothschild, and first day we got there, Paul Rothschild said, well, you know, making a record's like making a movie. Got a director.
Oh, no.
The director's in charge of everything. I mean, you know, we're sitting back and we can hear, we know what we're... Well, they didn't like the upright bass that I was playing, and I would play trumpet on a couple numbers. They didn't like that. So they said, well, can you play the Fender? Mm-hmm. Well, I couldn't play the Fender, so here I am trying to learn how to play the Fender while stuff is going on. And we're still working, and we're working hard and spending 12, you know, 14 hours a day in the studio and getting three tracks, or, you know, coming back to, we got just tracks with guitar, drums, and the other guitar, you know, mm-hmm. just the basic tracks we got in California. And it was painful because there were times where I thought my track was going on, but they were just let me play along, and they just weren't saving. You know, it's painful. It's painful. Wow. So we get back to New York, and they're committed to put the record together. And so the bass player that they had gotten rid of before came back in and put the bass tracks on, and we, you know, finished the record. Great expense, and it was a pretty good record, but overproduced, as they say, because Paul Rothschild was doing the Doors at the time, and he wanted to be, he was a classical musician, and this was his, you know, statement rather than what the Doors were, you know.
Right.
So we finished the record, and we were all happy with it, and we're trying to learn how to play together, because we'd never really played together now it's not a five-piece group, it's a six-piece group, and, well, how are we going to introduce these people, you know, now that they are our group and now that they have a record, what are we going to do? Well, we'll put them down to the Village Theater, or not the Village Theater, it's the Fillmore East, and we'll put them, well, let's put them under the Doors. Let's have the Doors play, and another group, which I can't remember, and Ars Nova played, and we just looked stiff, and we made it through, like, the weekend or whatever, two or three concerts, and it was just horrible, and then the group just, you know, split apart, and you know, being in a group and putting everything you had into it, basically, and then having pulled the plug on you. Well, I was still trying to learn how to play the bass, so I was practicing away.
Right.
That's the reason I picked up the electric bass, because
for that project specifically.
Yeah, for that project, and that project, it wasn't just it was a life. You know, you commit. Just like I'd committed to the Union Trio, and
did you commit though, or that was why that why you didn't why Ars Nova didn't stick was because, I mean, I guess
I was committed, but they, you know, maybe I'd gone a little crazy or whatever because I was just inadequate or whatever, you know, I just wasn't. You know, I mean, these are the trying times. The artist.
Did you listen to the art side of rock and roll? Did you listen to the new records that were coming out?
We listened to everything. We listened to everything, and we, you know, loved everything. Listened to, and they said, oh, you know, that's that bass player, he's good. You know, try to, you know, look, right. Listen to him. And we, I mean, we worked at it. It was just the same. But we were all musicians, all classical music, you know, classically trained, jazz musicians too. We all, we worked real hard. But that was, you know, there's another, it was 67, I think that came out.
Right.
So that went, you know, south real quick. We moved through that real quick. But
you were living in New York still, living in Hoboken?
I was not in Hoboken. I was living in Brooklyn Heights. I was married. Not Brooklyn Heights, south of Brooklyn Heights, whatever that is, Strong.
Carroll Gardens?
No, maybe I don't know what they call it. It's maybe they call it that now.
Or Boreham Hill, depending on which part of it you're in?
It was just...
Just south of Atlantic Avenue.
Right, right. And it was... I was married and had a kid and a little baby.
Right.
So I was still a musician, still trying to work, doing, I was writing songs, trying to write songs, trying to do this, do that, you know, but I was definitely a musician still, playing the bass, playing whatever I could play.
Right.
And then, you know, you just keep on keeping on.
What was the next step? I mean, what?
I guess the next step was I heard that Hoboken, they had made a record.
The Insect Trust.
Insect Trust. What a name. Great name. Great name. Well, I like Burroughs anyway, so that was went right along. And everybody seems to... He's an excellent choice, title choice for most of the groups I like still.
Yeah.
So I'm a big Steely Dan fan. Can I put that on?
Sure, sure. The Dead Boys, I hope. Or?
Huh?
And all the other names that have for bands and records and tunes that have been spawned by Burroughs through the years?
I don't know the Dead Boys. Uh-oh.
They were there. They didn't stick. Maybe they were the Ars Nova of their time.
Probably. There's got to have been a million one-shot. I mean, just they put the $100,000 in. That the manager got his slice.
Yeah.
He was paying us like 60. He paid me $65, $70 a week maybe to rehearse. And he was paying the rest of them 50, but I was married, you know, I could get $75.
Right. It's very considerate.
Yes, it was wonderful. And, okay, so, you know, I was rehearsing, practicing, trying. I wanted to be a songwriter. I wanted to sing on the record. Well, they didn't like my voice, so that didn't work. You know.
On the Insect Trust records?
No, not on the Insect Trust. Still on the Ars Nova. So I was just frustrated, basically. Just basically frustrated, not a happy time. And then the guys went to California. Life Magazine was following us around, and Eisenstadt took pictures of us all, and they did the cover. And I mean, they did a whole big thing. And so that went on. That moved off, and when something goes off and they meet and decide, well, let's get rid of it, let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
So and I contend that it was the person that, the bass player that they were having trouble with to begin with, his personality just wasn't right, and there he was back again, and they just went, so they went off to California to do something, and they fell apart out there. And then Pearson and Wyatt Day drove back, and they said, well, we had this Life magazine. Well, let's call him up and have him complete, you know, so that's why that was written up in Life magazine with new pictures, new band. And so they, you know, they did that. They tried to milk that. It didn't really work either for right. them. So that was, so the Insect Trust was in Hoboken, and it was just a couple bridges away from Brooklyn, and I had my car, and I put my bass in there, and was playing Fender by that time. And now, where does Albert come in that?
Uh-huh.
See, now, Albert was in there. He didn't disappear. I was off doing this thing, and then all of a sudden he calls me up, and I said, well, I'm playing Fender bass now. Oh, that'd be nice, you know. And so I think we played a Village...
You played the Cafe Ogogo, I think.
Cafe Ogogo, and what year was that?
That's 1968, probably okay. August.
So it's all
in
the same time.
Yeah.
You know, it's all in the same time frame. And Beaver and, I guess, Col Cobbs and just Albert and no Donald. I guess Donald must have gotten sick again.
Well, you tell me. What was your impression of the comings and goings of Donald Eiler, or coming and going?
I think it's just my contention that Albert was babysitting Donald and giving him something to do, something to hold on to, because he was he's having trouble, I think.
Mentally disturbed?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And
that's true for the whole time you knew him, you're saying, or that it came on as through?
No, I think it was, you know, you play with guys and, you know, and he just seemed a little, he was not, you know, falling down crazy or whatever, but he was mentally disturbed.
Right.
Is that true?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's...
I shouldn't ask you, right?
In the eyes of the state, he was and has been, you know, treated as such for many, many years.
And I don't know. I've read other things that said that Albert was, you know, his mother wanted him to take care of Donald, and there's some rancor going back and forth about that,
right.
Of course. And, you know, the poor guy's dead. Albert is, isn't he?
He didn't?
He's not living in Vegas?
That would be a different world, I think.
Yeah, it would be.
But Albert called you up. Now, maybe this is a good question to ask about relative to the experience that you had in between times and that Albert had. You haven't seen him for more than a year, I'm guessing, since summer of 67, and we're talking about the late summer of 68.
After the
Newport.
That was it, you know. And I was already... launched in this other thing, which I had totally committed. You know, I'm sorry, I'm busy.
Right.
You know.
Well, do you think he called you up in between times and said,
no.
But you were pretty much tied up with other things.
Yeah, tied up with other things. And I don't know what his activity was in that period.
Well, what we know is what's revealed in the recordings, which is that he, you know, met a new musical partner in Mary Maria or Mary Parks, and she seems to have a lot to do with the way that his music shaped up by the time that you encountered it again. Is that the way you sense it?
I sense it that I didn't... No, I don't know. Is she the strong influence? Is that... You're trying to ask me, right? I don't know. I was trying to play the bass like Donald Duck Dunn is what I was trying to
do. Yeah.
No, that's... You know, and Albert said, yeah, that's good. And, you know, maybe... And see... He would say, well, maybe that's the way that you got to go. You know, that's the way I'll go. What the heck, you know?
Huh.
You know, he did the go-go gig, and they liked it, and I guess he got Thiel to come. Thiel came down, and he liked it, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know how the things work, you know, but...
Well, here's one... Let me go for one concrete thing. Now, you've reported that on this gig at the Café Ogogo, which was sort of... It ends up being a little bit of time, just a little bit before the Newgrass recording, which
right.
I guess no matter how which way you slice it, you've got to say that's a definite change in Albert Eiler's trajectory of music.
Absolutely. And I don't know if it's my fault. Don't blame me.
Well, it can't
or you can blame
it can't be your fault,
well,
because you
good.
Were there before that. But here's one thing that does seem to show up right then is Eiler's with the new record company. This is the second record he's making for them. And it seems like on every record that he makes for Impulse as a studio record, he sings something. And you've reported that in this Café Ogogo gig, he started to sing there.
That's correct.
By his own choice. That there was no, as you say, there was no
producer.
No, he
forced him, yeah. No. But he wanted, so the Maria thing, possibly, she wanted to be a star too, perhaps.
Maybe.
And then it didn't happen with Thiel, because on that first record, well, I guess because he brought in studio guys and overdubbed and cut it, and they had his singers and the arrangements, and we just went and laid down tracks, and Pretty Purdy is, you know, he's super.
Yeah.
Just
well,
super.
At the Café Ogogo then, what did Albert sing? Do you remember? Was he just bursting into song? Because he has a way of having this wordless song thing that shows up before that. Was that
I think it? I sing along with him too. I'm not
at the Café Ogogo.
There's a good chance, you know.
Let me roll you back.
I mean, I just, you know, maybe I'm stepping out of thing, you know. But I always, you know, I like to sing every once in a while, and maybe, you know, he got the idea, hey, well, I can sing. You know, he can sing. What the heck?
Yeah. So, can I roll you back 1 year? Now, you said that at Newport that there were rehearsals for Newport.
There, I think we had one.
And he sings on the Newport gig.
He does?
Mm-hmm. He sings that pentatonic melody that some people call Japan, and he called it something else or nothing else.
Okay. Well,
you know, he sort of opens up wordlessly just to sing the melody of the thing. Does it sound? Is there any dim recollection that maybe he sang at the Newport rehearsals too, or that was a surprise for you? What I should do is pull out the tape and play that for you.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about.
But yeah, but now you did send me the tape, but I can't, you know, I can't recall that. But hey, it was Albert. He could do anything you wanted, you know. I mean, he'd do it, and he felt good, and you know, he said, that's right, you know, that's it.
Well, but by the time you meet up with him for Newgrass, part of it is that he's singing. He's singing more than just, you know, what he would play on tenor. He's now singing words, and the words are written by somebody because they've been
worked
out. Had
been Maria, right?
Well, were they?
It wasn't me, I know.
Nobody's accusing you of writing.
No, okay, words. No. And he could have written the words too. You know, he said, "If here I'm a smart man and I play music and I want to have my music heard and how am I going to do that? You know, and when I look around me and I'm just talking off the top of my head, but what am I going to do? I'm going to I want to make money too.
If you can't beat him, join him.
Yeah." And I don't know, you know.
Did you ever have any sense from anything that Albert said or the way he carried himself that he was that he would have thought that either A, that he was ever trying to beat him, in other words, that his angle was different from rock and roll and he was going to make it stick, or B, that he finally capitulated and said, "Nah, let me just go that way because that's the way the kids are going."
You know, I can't really say, but I probably should. But I've been known to waffle for years, you know.
Well, it just seems like you had a similar experience to a certain
absolutely.
Extent. That in the interim, you kind of said, well, this is where the jobs are. Why am I going to stick it out over right. here with the art end?
Right. Well, that's probably... So if that happened to him, maybe it was an echo, a reaction. And he had a real name, et cetera, et cetera. And he could pretty much do what he wanted. And he did.